Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Stephen Phillips, translator of Gungatius Tutvachintamani, or Jewel of Reflection on the Truth About Epistemology, published in 2020 by Bloomsbury Academic Press. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Your book, which has just come out, is a English translation of what's really a masterpiece of Sanskrit language philosophy. And if I'm not mistaken, it's never been translated before in its entirety, certainly not in English. So this is a work by a 14th century philosopher, Gungatius. He lived in Northeast India, and we'll talk about his biography in a minute. So he wrote on epistemology, metaphysics, language, and logic, a range of things. And normally what I would do is I ask the author to tell me their book's thesis in a nutshell, but I'm talking to you and not Gungatius. So let me ask you how you would succinctly, if at all possible, give a nutshell of what is Gungatius arguing for in his Tutvachintamani.
Well, first of all, there is much ellipsis in Gungatius and in philosophic writing in Sanskrit across the board, including Gungatius' title, Tutvachintamani. Partly, titles are meant to be poetic, and Tutvachintamani has a double entendre, the double meaning of reflection on the truth. That's what tutva means. But also, a chintamani is a wish-fulfilling jewel. So it's reflection on the truth. And the word that's elided is pramana tutvachintamani. So it's the truth about what? It's the truth about the pramana. So, and actually the elided word in the title, pramana, gets emphasis, even though it's not there. And the book is arranged around four pramana, and pramana are knowledge sources, the four knowledge sources of perception, inference, analogy, and testimony. Now, analogy is not so familiar to us just as philosophers or human beings, whereas we all get by every day with perception and inference and testimony. So I don't really want to talk a lot about analogy from the get-go, but emphasize rather that there are these three very, commonly supposed sources of knowledge: perception, inference, and testimony, learning something new from something told to us by a reliable source, that working out exactly how these three sources of knowledge work, and along with, in general, what is knowledge, how do we certify that we know something or other, and various other topics having to do with the specific knowledge sources. The book is divided in Sanskrit into, not into three volumes, but into four. One for each of the pramana, one for each of the knowledge sources. I'm not so sure that Gangesha is himself committed to analogy as a knowledge source, because it gets very short treatment. But Gangesha is, it's important to know from the get-go that he's a member of the of a long-running school of philosophy known as Nyaya. And Nyaya, he's in the 14th century. Nyaya gets going really early, probably more than 1400 years before him. There's some dispute about the date of the earliest Nyaya text called the Nyaya Sutra, but maybe 100 BCE or 100 CE. And there's been a long tradition of development of Nyaya where philosophers try to stay true to the core principles, core positions of Nyaya, but they also expand and elaborate and sometimes totally innovate. Gangesha is famous in classical circles as the originator of what's called new Nyaya, Navya Nyaya. But I've thought a lot about that topic, and some scholars think that his predecessor, Udayana, who lived a couple of centuries before he did, was really the great innovator of Navya Nyaya. But no, every Nyaya philosopher, Nyaya philosopher is called a Nyayaka, every Nyayaka innovates to some extent and also continues the positions that have been inherited from predecessors. So the very distinction of Navya Nyaya is somewhat problematic. And some later Nyaya philosophers count Gangesha as part of old Nyaya, Nyaya, and only Raghunatha, someone about two centuries later than Gangesha, as the real innovator of what's called New Nyaya.
So where exactly to place this innovation is controversial. But one thing that you're doing in your translation is giving a new audience a chance to make some of these kinds of conclusions about what's going on philosophically in the text. What do you characterize the goals of your translation as being then? Who are you hoping will read the book? What's the audience? And why do you think Gangesha's work was important to translate? You mentioned Udayana, the Vajraspati Mishra is another philosopher. There's a whole lot of untranslated works in Sanskrit. Why Gangesha?
Well, that's a tough question. It has to do with careerism. Who is both a good philosopher and so worthy to work on, and has not been worked on so much that I feel very privileged to have been trained as an analytic philosopher and as a Sanskritist, because there were any number of works that I could have worked on and have worked on that very few people who know analytic philosophy have worked on. And so, some translations of very good philosophic works in Sanskrit get misrepresented in English by subtle errors concerning epistemic terms. And one has to be very careful and also provide a background material so that one doesn't make terrible mistake, such as to say, as many Sanskrit translators have said, that there can be false knowledge. Now, an analytic philosopher is, false knowledge. Okay, I can't understand that. So they put the book down. So But that's, you know, mitya jnana in Sanskrit is really something like false belief, or, you know, there's the target is something that can be vertical or non-vertical. So it's not knowledge. So one has to be careful in using the terminology in English that not only accurately renders the Sanskrit, but also does not, that ties into the terminology, particularly the technical terms that are commonly employed in analytic thought.
Yeah. And so back to Gungatia as a philosopher, then my question about why Gungatia is not meant to suggest that you shouldn't have translated his work. It's just what's great about him.
Well, what's really great about him is, I must say, I was steered by his reputation. The founder, he was said, you know, in Sanskrit circles, he's often said to be the founder of New Nyaya. And there are many, many commentaries in Sanskrit written on his work, on single sentences that he has written, for example, the definition of entailment or natural entailment, vyapti. It has had tons of commentary and analysis in Sanskrit. So the tradition directed me to Gungatia, where I admittedly, some of the scholarly work, particularly by some very good German scholars and Japanese scholars, would put as a matter of a world-class philosopher, would put perhaps among Nyayakas, Nyaya philosophers, would put Udayana a little higher. After all, Udayana integrated an ontological system that grew up under the name Vaisheshika, or a kind of atomism, with the epistemology that's in the Nyaya Sutra and the longstanding Nyaya tradition. And all everybody after Udayana, including Gungatia, it has this fusion of ontological categories and epistemology. That goes all the way back to the Nyaya Sutra itself. But I must say, just as a kind of insider point that people probably will not appreciate, Udayana, of all the philosophers that I have tried to read in Sanskrit, I find the most difficult, because I don't know if you yourself have tried to read Udayana, but he's highly elliptical, Gungatia has very long, complex sentences and ellipsis. It's a common feature, but nothing like Udayana. Really hard.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. I looking at some of the translations on him, his work that I've tried to teach to students, it's a real challenge. So let's go back to Gungatia then. How did you get interested in Gungatia? How did he come across your radar first?
Being a professional philosopher and Sanskritist, Gungatia was a natural choice. The two best known and also most astute combination of philosopher and Sanskritist in the writing in English in the generation before me were two scholars, one Jayan Mohanty and the other Bimal Motilal. Both of these fellows had as their specialty Nyaya, and both translated sections of the Tattvachintami, a whole just one section about 1/16 of the perception chapter. Remember, there are four chapters in the Tattvachintami, the jewel, we call it the jewel. And reflection on the truth about epistemology, was translated in the Harvard Oriental series by Motilal, I think, in 1968. Mohanty translated a very important section on how we know that we know. But here three sixteenths of the whole Perception chapter have been translated by these very great scholars before me. So, and other bits of that chapter have been translated piecemeal, maybe one or two other sections. Same with the inference chapter. About 20 sections, four or five, been translated here or there in journals. A whole book was devoted to the section on the inferential subject in the inference chapter. And there are only about 40 lines of Sanskrit. So scholarship up to this point of my work had really taken the Tetrachintamani to be a series of journal articles. Didn't really have that all together, but actually when you put it all together, you see some larger themes. For example, the default acceptability of the beliefs embedded in fresh awareness. And then a second level, which is what they may call animal knowledge or animal awareness, whether that be so uptake fused with acceptance, with testimony. Somebody tells you something, you automatically believe it. You don't. So there's this default goodness coupled with defeasibility. And when you look at the inference chapter in particular, you see, but also the perception chapter, a little less with the testimony chapter, that the concern is how is what is presumptively knowledge certified or shown actually not to be knowledge, defeated. The whole last part of the inference chapter, which has not been talked about very much, is concerned with the concept of bodhika. I mentioned the Sanskrit because there's a great English cognate, bodhika, defeater, a blocker. It blocks a blocker of knowledge. And sometimes you have standing defeaters, but sometimes, I don't know, you say everything that is earthen is scratchable by iron. And you have a lot of inductive evidence for that. But then diamonds are discovered. And so that's a defeater of the vyapti that permits inference, this entailment relation that is much concerned with in the inference chapter. So by putting all the chapters together, you can sort of see, I think this is a point that not many people have really appreciated, that the whole layout of the epistemology has to do with sort of presumptive acceptability of the beliefs embedded in fresh news, whether that come from perception or inference or testimony, and then concern with what might undercut that belief or certify. And we've moved to a second level. Now, all philosophic discussions at a second level. So even though we model even certification on the first level of animal knowledge, so that we look at sort of natural inferences and get our model for how to do inference in a formal way, when we come to philosophic issues, it's all nothing is automatic. Everything has to be argued for. And one of the great joys of reading Sanskrit philosophy, as you know, is unlike English, you think, you know, we're told in graduate school or even undergraduate that the métier of philosophy is argument, and we learn the structures of argument. But I have encountered no work in any Western philosophy from the Greeks through Kripke who have argument so central to the way that a philosophic text proceeds. Everything has to be supported. And so the genre of philosophy is one where you're always looking for the better reasons.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for a second. So for our listeners who may not know anything about Indian philosophy, the term inference, I think maybe we should spend a little bit of time unpacking what you mean by that in the context of pramanas, because that's a term that has some ambiguities.
Yes.
I should maybe use
inference star. I mean, I think of it, perception, testimony works better. There's also a problem with the word perception, which is ambiguous, but whether between the process and the result. But you're absolutely right. The word inference in English has much broader semantic range than the word anumana, which is a knowledge taken as one of the basic knowledge sources in Gangesha and Sanskrit philosophy in general. So it's important. Also, a lot of the reasoning that goes on around an inference or around perception concerned with certification or defeating is called tarka. And it has to do with something like, you know, the Socratic Olynkus, where you try to show an opponent's position lands in contradiction or infinite regress, it lacks economy compared to some other position. All that reasoning, which really fills out the stuff of a philosophic text, that's not really called inference. We might call that inference in English. Or inference to the best explanation. That's not what's going on in Sanskrit. Inference is a very tight form where there is an inferential subject. There is some property that is known to qualify the inferential subject. That property is known to stand in an entailment relationship with some other property. And so when you see the property F as qualifying some individual A, and you know from wide experience and also other testimony that everything that is an F is a G, then you automatically carry out the inference that A is a G. So that process is looked upon as inference. And, you know, what Westerners would look at, I don't know, as a deductive inference with, modus ponens or modus tollens or disjunctive sibilant, that gets built into the Sanskrit system. They're surely aware of this, but this pattern, which has an inductive element, how you find out that every F is a G, a lot of focus on that, what is focused on as a knowledge source. Mm-hmm.
And so what you just mentioned a moment ago with the sort of automatic nature of inference, the anumana kind of inference here, that's what you're calling animal knowledge, or what you've other places called unreflective knowledge.
It's unreflective knowledge, and it's it's like if someone tells you, hey, smoke, you don't oh wow, let's work that out, let's see, there must be smoke somewhere, oh, wherever there's smoke there's fire, oh, there must be fire there. No, you get the hell out. Or, you know, you get some water, you know, immediately. But there are then philosophic inferences, proofs of the existence of God, proofs of atoms, proofs or inferences about the self, which is disputed in Indian philosophy, right? Buddhists denied that there is any self. We have these inferences, and basically the pattern will be, there'll be an inference put out with an inferential subject and a prover property that's supposed to be modifying the inference or qualifying the inferential subject, an entailment relation between the prover property and the property to be proved, sometimes called the probandum, and then the conclusion drawn. But then a lot of discussion will go around filling this out. For example, in one of the inferences that Gangesha takes up for Ishvara, that there is a creator of or arranger of not a stuff but of atoms, right? Stuff is the atoms themselves are eternal and uncreated, but it's reasoned that, or it's inferred that there has to be a overseer that brings the otherwise disconnected atoms into connection. Now, so there's an very trim inference that puts forth the case for a lord, a creative Ishvara or world arranger Ishvara. But then there'll be some reasoning that fills out the nature of Ishvara, such as Ishvara has to be omniscient, otherwise Ishvara couldn't do the work that Ishvara is inferred, that causes us to infer Ishvara in the first place. So it's possible to fill out the conclusion it's not just that there is a Lord. What's the Lord like? So there's this supplemental reasoning that goes around the inference that fills in details.
So let's talk about what Gangesha is doing that's innovative or extending earlier Nyaya philosophy, because what you've just described in many ways is kind of standard Nyaya ideas, that there's let's take the smoke and the fire case, because that's maybe easier than the Ishvara one for a moment. What does he do with the smoke and fire relationship that's interesting?
I must say that the question of in what ways Gangesha is an innovator is a really tough question, because it requires a command of the whole tradition that is beyond myself and I think scholarship. After all, just the core Nyaya Sutra commentators, which is Gautama, the Nyaya Sutra, and Vatsyayana, the first commentator, the Bhashya, and Jyotakara, who's elaborating the commentary of Udayana, and then Vachaspati, who writes a lot of notes on Jyotaka, and then Udayana comes along. That runs about in Sanskrit, maybe what, 3,000 pages?
Yeah, right.
And there are these other figures who are not in the Nyaya Sutra commentarial tradition. My own sense, look, there's lots of sort of brilliant, succinct definitions, for example, of knowledge that Gangesha gives, of pervasion or entailment that he gives. It's not so much, I mean, as a whole, he has packaged the epistemology even though in my translation I think runs 1,900 pages, he's packaged it in a very succinct way, where also you see, and this is not really appreciated in Nyaya, you see the coherence relationships, you see how it all hangs together as a, and I think Gangesha is underappreciated. And Nyaya as a whole for its sense of coherence of a whole epistemological system, indeed a whole worldview, because, you know, the epistemology is all wrapped up in ontology. And the ontological questions, I think, are more difficult to resolve and a little more brittle than the epistemology seems totally worthy of study by the most adept epistemologists of our own day. The ontology, it doesn't have such strength. A very simple system of atoms and other basic types of Brio, and a lot of concern about universals and so on. I mean, this is tied into the epistemology, for example, in the section on testimony, on the chapter on testimony. There's concern, well, you know, how does a sentence give us new knowledge? And what's the basic relationship between the sentence and the fact that it would convey to a hearer? You know, if a speaker knows the truth and to convey it faithfully, well, it's not just a referential relationship. There's an indirect indication, lakshana, and then this notion of lakshana of not following the normal convention of relations between words and objects, but, you know, innovating and meaning something in what we might say in English is a metaphoric way. Well, that tool of philosophy of language is then used in the ontological context by some of Gangesha's opponents of the school known as Mimamsa to argue for universals that we're always indirectly indicating, or there's this sort of metaphorical relationship to the universal when we refer to particulars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's just one example of how the ontology gets all bound up with the epistemology. And sometimes I think even Gangesha, who's very clear-sighted, does get too absorbed in minor ontological concerns, and it's very easy to lose the big picture because they are very intricate issues. I mean, you know, maybe universals, you know, just think of the history of the topic of universals in Western philosophy. I mean, nowadays, after Wittgenstein and a whole bunch of others criticizing it, maybe there are not very many realists about universals. But boy, there sure were in the history of philosophy from Plato to Aristotle and so on. And similarly in Nyaya and other schools of classical Indian philosophy.
Well, let me try asking the question about pervasion one more time in a different way, and not emphasizing so much the innovation, but what it is that Gangesha is doing with what you're calling an entailment or vyapti. One of the things we were just talking about is the idea that with repeated observations, we can secure knowledge of, for instance, the relationship between smoke and fire, so that from the observation that there's smoke in some place, we can infer there's fire in that same place. But there's a worry, right, that's familiar to analytic philosophers that what if there's a counterexample out there? If we haven't checked for every possible counterexample, what potential number of observations can secure that relationship, well, right? So what does Gangesha say about this? This is something
thank you. That's like, you know, batting practice, giving us low pitch, because he has something very interesting and, to my mind, correct to say on this point. He says, "Look, the skeptic is absolutely right. We're talking about inference as a generator of knowledge about the world. Again, we need to know that." The use of the word inference in the corresponding word in Sanskrit, anumana, has much narrower semantic range than inference in English. In particular, we're not talking about verbal entailments. We're talking about factual relations where we know that there is some universal, some general proposition, wherever smoke, there is fire. And here's how we answer the question about, hey, nobody's seen all instances of smoke and no one has seen all instances of fire in their relations. Well, we could be wrong. But we need inference to get along in life. Notice that the skeptic assumes what we call anumana, these factual, these natural inferences, in discussing with us, because he or she assumes that when he or she speaks, we're understanding the words that are being said, so that they assume that there is this factual relation between speaking and a hearer understanding. Gangesha uses that example, and he also says, hey, well, look, watch the skeptic. Let's look at the behavior. That skeptic, who wants to get rid of mosquitoes, lights a fire to get some smoke, and to get rid of the mosquitoes. So we realize that we can be wrong, but that doesn't mean that we don't have knowledge. Now, it may be that at some, you know, we don't know that we know. In fact, Maya is very specific that normally we don't know that we know. Knowing that you know is so you know, KP does not entail KKP in analytic jargon. That we have to make some special effort. We have to certify. And the processes of certification, the certification conditions are different depending upon not only the knowledge source, perception, inference, or testimony, but also what's known. So we might know that we know. We might take the trouble. Pramanya Nyapti, there's one of the most complicated sections comes right at the beginning. It's entitled this: how do we know that we know? It comes at the beginning of the perception chapter. There's some, you know, internalists, the Mimamsakas and the Vedantins are internalists on the Sanskrit. So, you know, they think that, no, you don't need certification, that knowledge, they sort of misunderstand the presumptive goodness of awareness, anubhava, as self-certified knowledge. But Gangesha, he fights the skeptic on with these pragmatic arguments that, hey, we need it. We could be wrong. We're not claiming, you know, that we know all the way up. We're saying you give us the evidence, we'll give up what we claim. But when it comes to arguing with these self-certificationalists, Mimamsakas and Vedantas, he uses doubt. He says, look. You're walking along. You see a river in the distance, and it is a river. It's a river, but you're in unfamiliar territory. You can doubt whether it's a river, even though your perception, and as you walk up closer, you see, you end up drinking the water from the river. And you make the inference, hey, if my perception had not been knowledge, I wouldn't be drinking this water right now. It's a kind of modus tollens, certificational inference in that case. Sometimes it's misunderstood. Actually, certification works by source identification. If you identify something by perception or as having its good origin, so in Sanskrit, everybody's concerned with pedigree. So you got these good origins, the pramana origins. But how do you know you have pramana origins? You identify the source. Well, how do you identify a source? Well, usually, see, these sources are natural processes that are hooking up facts with knowers. And, you know, since there's natural processes, there's always something that's hidden. You never get the whole thing. Just like, you know, I'm looking at Malcolm Keating, I don't see, I'm facing him, I don't see the back of his head. But I still say I see Malcolm Keating. I don't see the whole of Malcolm Keating. When you identify a knowledge source and certify your knowledge, it's usually by what are called guna and dosha. Guna are excellences, so they're marks. There are marks of the operation of knowledge sources. So they And that's really a matter of inference. We see that, perception in these circumstances has these indicators, these signs. That so we see them, we can certify that this is a veritable perceptual process that's giving us the truth about some fact.
So would one way of distinguishing between, for instance, Mimamsa and Vedanta and Gangesha and Nyaya philosophers here in epistemology, would this work? Tell me if you think this is apt, that for Mimamsa, you either know something or you don't know it. You have an experience that arises, and it either turns out to be knowledge or it doesn't. You can have an obstacle to it and doubt it, but then you regain that same level of knowledge. But for Nyaya, there's unreflective or animal knowledge, and then there's a way in which we can strengthen that knowledge, or we can have a different, there's a sense of almost degrees. I'm not sure if we would want to put it that way. Would that be right?
Yes, very good. You know, and one of the fallacies that I find most interesting that are taken up as the defeaters of what we presume to know, but it can be defeated, is called sat pratipaksha, and it's I translate this as counter inference. I think most people, other translators do as well. And here's an example. Okay, you say by perception see that there's this individual A that has the property F, and you have had wide experience reinforced by testimony. Everything in your experience, every F has turned out to be a G, and you've done a lot of research and you've heard a lot about this. Every F is a G, and so you infer, and even you're very self-conscious about this, and you present it in a debate, and you say, hey, A is a G. Why? Because A is an F and every F is a G. Well, then someone comes along and says, hey, and so we would say, and look, it and A, let's, in this thought experiment, A really is a G. So, okay, you got knowledge, right? It's true that A is a G, and you have inferred it in the right way. You know that A is an F, and you know that every F is a G. So somebody comes along and says, A is also an H. And you say, oh, yeah, that seems true. And look at this. Every H in our experience correlates with a not G. So I've got this counter inference that A is not a G. It's not a G. Is a not G on the basis of A's being an H, which you see A is an H, and there's this evidence that every H is not a G. Well, Gangesha's position on this is you knew, you had knowledge before you encountered the counter inference, but after encountering the counter inference, even though the counter inference is a bad inference. It doesn't have a true conclusion. A, in the terms of the thought experiment, we're assuming that A is really a G. You lose your right to assert that A is a G until you can show what's wrong with the other inference. So there's a social dimension to knowledge. I mean, you may lose it. You lose it. You lose it when somebody comes up and challenges you in a very good way like that.
So would that be then a distinction between losing and gaining knowledge and assertability, or do you think that he's bringing these two things together?
Yeah, he's bringing them together. I mean, assertability goes with having knowledge and also having, I mean, you might even be wrong, of course. I mean, assertability is wider than knowledge in that, you have a false belief, from your own perspective, it looks good. So you have the right to assert it by Nyaya standards, but, you know, you don't have knowledge because, you know, it's not true.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned debates, let's talk a little bit then about the inferences that Gangesha makes in the jewel that are about metaphysics, some of these that you mentioned, for instance, the existence of God or the self. here we see, and you've talked about this in your Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry a bit, here we see not just his application of inference, but also some of his some hints into how he understands ethical living and so on. So I'm particularly interested in one inference, which is the inference for the self, which Nyaya is well known for these inferences, that there is an immaterial, persisting self, which is the subject of desires and memories and things like this. But here, Gungesha does something interesting. He uses a kind of inference known as negative or absence-only inference, which is itself contentious. Can you say just a little bit about this discussion here? I think it's kind of interesting.
First of all, the inferences that he spends the most time with, philosophic inferences where he's asserting the conclusion and defending it at length, the one on the self, the one on the Ishvara, and one on the possibility of liberation, of mukti, of some ultimate summum bonum mystical experience. These three... personally, this may be a view that indicates a somewhat jaded perspective about writing philosophic texts, but I think that he's picked these inferences because he wants to illustrate his philosophical system, his system of inferences, and particularly the feeders, because he illustrates, they're not only the most famous fallacies, there are five of them, but also the various forms of Tarka, such as infinite regress or heaviness and lightness, or presupposing what's at issue and begging the question. So he's able, particularly with the Ishvara inference. It's so long. I think it must take me 200 pages to translate that section. That at the end, you're not really sure that he is actually a theist. He's put up such good objections, but he has illustrated his system of reasoning, not just inference, but Tarka, all the different forms of Tarka and fallacies and so on, countering fallacies, defeaters, and then, restores and so on. He's illustrating it all. Okay, I think the same thing holds for the inference about the self. And he's not really original here, but the idea is we start with a certain ontological system that has 11 substances. And they're the atomic substances, but they're also non-atomic substances, such as ether, which is supposed to be the medium of sound, and manas, and buddhi. Manas is a kind of sensory mind, and buddhi is cognition or mentality. So what he does, he says, look, we find that there are certain phenomena that we're aware of, such as desires, such as knowledge itself, cognition, effort, action. And by various traits of these phenomena, we group them in what we call qualities, properties. Properties maybe in English is broader than the term guna in Sanskrit. But guna is understood through a long tradition, like I said, goes all the way back to the Vaisheshika, sort of sister school to Nyaya, that's focused on ontology. All guna qualify substances. There can't be free-floating guna. Now, there's some arguments about that Gungesha doesn't go into, but they're in the Vaisheshika Sutra, and I think One of them is in the Nyaya Sutra as well, having to do with certain maintenance, you know, black before baking and red after baking of a pot. There's an endurance of a property bearer where the properties change, and several other arguments that converge on the distinction between subject and property, with the conclusion that all properties have to have substances that bear. There are no free-floating properties. Now, you might challenge that, but he starts with that. I mean, that's a given, that a property has to have a property bearer. So properties such as desire, cognition, effort, and so on, you go down the list. Earthen things, watery things, fiery things, combinations of those, ether, so on. None of those are candidates. We look at other earthen things. They don't have cognition. They don't have desire. So we go through the list, and it's a process of elimination. None of these properties fit as qualifying the various substances on the traditional list. So it has to be some other substance. It's not on the list. We call that Atman, which it's the bearer of psychological properties. There is an Atman. There is a self.
So there's a self because of our inability to observe the right kind of potential bearer for these qualities anywhere else.
That's right. So
epistemologically, though, isn't there something kind of potentially funny going on here with this kind of negative or absence-only inference? Isn't there some kind of background contention about this? Because when we look for smoke and fire, we inductively support our inference from the presence of smoke to the presence of fire by looking to see smoke and fire together. How are we helping ourselves to this thing called Atman based on non-observation? So in other words, this the question about absence-only inference here. It's sort of epistemic status is contentious. So I was just curious how Gungesha explains how that works.
To tell the truth, again, this is the reason why I don't think his heart is totally into this inference, also like the theistic inference, in that it's sort of the standard view in Nyaya is voiced best by the Nyaya Sutra commentator called Udyotakara, writing the second level of commentary after Vatsyayanan. And Udyotakara comes out very clearly and says, hey, we know the Atman or self by perception. And, you know, I see a pot. What does I mean? It means the self. Or better, in the apperception, I see that I see a pot. Now, we don't have to see all of the self, but we're seeing that, you know, the self with one of its properties. Again, I don't see the whole of Malcolm Keating when I'm facing him. You know, I don't see a whole of the shirt. I not every thread. Surely not the backsides. So we don't see everything about a self when we perceive. when we apperceive that the self is qualified by the process of seeing, or inferring, or thinking, or any of the other psychological properties. So I think that that's really the strong background argument. Now, Buddhists come along and say, look, that's wrong. You don't perceive a self, and they have some argument, some inferences that everything is momentary, like clouds, and they have various evidence, and they say, these things are disputed. You can't give us any undisputed examples of endurance over time. And so Gungesha says, okay, since, you know, it's like a Satpratipaksha, okay, inside Nyaya, we don't really need an inference for the self. We don't need an inference for the self. It's not a controversial. We do. We construct inferences on controversial topics. Things that are known by perception. We don't need an inference. Why waste your time? But the Buddhists, these crazy Buddhists, you know, they think they don't perceive a self. So we need some. We don't want to beg the question against them, so that we have this inference. Now, yeah, it's a negative. Yeah, we don't find pots having desire, right? There's a kind of absence there, right? There's an absence of desire. Well, again, I mean, there's nothing so strange about absences. They have a particular kind of logic, and the broad sense of logic. You know, they have to have an absentee. There has to be what's absent, which we have to be familiar with. And there's also got to be a locus, you know, like we know that there aren't any horns on rabbits. And the absentee, the counterpositive, the horn, has to be something that's perceptible to know that there are no horns on rabbits' heads. The idea is, if there were one, we would perceive it. And now, you know, so some absential cognitions aren't like that. But you might want to say, how do you know that the pot doesn't have desire? Well, again, it's going to be behavior. we don't see the pot getting up and making effort and so on and so forth. We just, you know, we would perceive certain indicators of these properties were these things to have them, and we don't find it. We don't find it. But these things have to have a property bearer. So that property bearer we call, you know, the property bearer of psychological properties is the psyche, the self.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's how it goes.
Right. And this is where the other, it's not a pramana or knowledge source, but it's a tool, tarka or hypothetical or counterfactual reasoning, that would come in and kind of fill in the gaps. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Tarka comes in to show that the opponent's thesis, the materialist thesis, the Buddhist thesis faces unwanted consequences, either infinite regress or contradiction and so on.
Right. So throughout these three volumes, the four books in the original Sanskrit, the four pramanas here, what we're really getting, it seems like, is just a whirlwind through a bunch of debates. But these are with Buddhists, with Mimamsa, with Vedanta, but these are embedded within Gangesha's sort of overarching aim of showing this broad system cohering together, epistemology, ontology, and so on.
What's fantastic about Indian philosophy is there are these different camps, these different schools and different literatures. And they're, you know, internal considerations, but external controversies. And so these shape the philosophic texts of Nyaya. The early texts of Nyaya took Buddhist in the main as opponent to be refuted. Gangesha, he's very much aware of Buddhist positions, but he is fighting mainly with the ritualists, the Mimamsakas, who have a very complex system and literature and factions within the broad Mimamsaka umbrella or under it. And I think Gangesha, he probably taught Mimamsa. He seems to know Mimamsa so well. Though when it comes to ethics, you mentioned ethics, and there's something explicit where he, you know, lays out an ethical philosophy in the way Immanuel Kant or John Stuart Mill does. But Mimamsa is an ethical system. Mimamsa has a certain injunctions for the right way to live, dharma, that is articulated by the highest of the caste, and also the defense of the caste system, and so on. This ethical system is opposed in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Upanishads and other places in Buddhism and Jainism with much more egalitarian and a system of respect for consciousness, ahimsa, non-injury, not harming anything that has any kind of consciousness. And Gengesha shows in a number of places that he sides with the, I want to call it a, it's really a kind of soteriological ethics, because you're thought to, that by practicing non-injury and so on, not only are you, it's a good, good for other people, good for animals, you're not hurting them, but it's also good for yourself. You're making progress towards the summum bonum, which is a certain kind of, thought of as a certain kind of enlightenment within Buddhism and the Bhagavad Gita. And in Gengesha, seems to be within the Shaivite religious tradition opposed to Mimamsa, though I'm digging this out of some of the examples that he uses in quotations. He doesn't really lay it out as a systematic view.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for taking us through what's just a wealth of philosophy in Sanskrit here. I suppose with the title of the book, that makes sense. Sorry?
There's so much more to talk about. I wanted to talk about Lakshana.
That was my last question. Let's do that for real quick here. What's what would you want to say about Gengesha and Lakshana, or indication?
Well, just that he has a knockdown argument why reference cannot be the only semantic relation. Also, he has much discussion of the two, that there has to be this other semantic relation where when you say the moon, what you really mean is the beloved's face is like the moon, or you say usher in the sticks, you're not really talking you're talking about the ascetics that are carrying walking sticks, or the villages in the Ganga, Gangayam Gosha. The referentialists want to say, look, by convention, by noticing the convention that ties word and object, we know that sometimes the word Ganga, by convention, means the bank of the river. So we don't need Lakshana, we just need reference. It's just that, there Aksha can mean eye or dice. And we just have to know, there's a lot of double, homonyms. You just have to know the conventions. But Gengesha says, look at the thousands of usages we would have to know to understand what people mean when they use the word Ganga, if it's all a matter of reference. However, with this flexible semantic relation of Lakshana, indirect indication, we use context and other cues to figure out what the speaker's intention is when he or she says something that on the surface meaning doesn't make sense, right? So he's very good on that. He's very good on the utility of Lakshana, but he gets kind of bogged down when he looks at all the, he inherits a lot of, a kind of radical referentialism from his Nyaya predecessors, where every word and semantic element has meaning independently of its context and its sentence, abhihittanvaya vada, as opposed to the Prabhakara holistic view that you put together the meaning in your head and then the sentence as a whole picks out a fact. I actually think he just hadn't made up his mind which system is he feels like, because it is the standard Nyaya view, all that goes all the way back to Vatsyayana to Udyodhakara borrowing from Kumarala, the Mimamsaka, that he has to stay true to that position. But I think he really favors the holistic view of Bakaras.
Yeah, there's quite a lot in Gangesha that we could dig into if we had several hours, because he does. He goes into language and quite a number of things, but much of what you've written is available on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, at least some introduction.
Gangesha, just Gangesa.
Yeah, and then we'll, of course, put a link up to the book. Let me ask you one last question, though. Now that this monumental effort is complete and the book is out, what are you working on now? What are you working on these days?
I hesitate to say, because there's this misconception of Indian philosophy being all about, you know, hocus pocus religious topics, you know, yoga, enlightenment, and so on. But that's what I'm working on, Shankara, and some topics in Vedanta. And I, by the way, Shankara, you know, he's a famous Vedantin, but gosh, does he know Nyaya? He starts with scripture, the Upanishads, being giving us this animal knowledge, and he even compares scripture to the way that cows know things, and that what we are doing in the Brahma Sutra is certifying by using Tarka and reasoning to firm up the conclusions about the self and enlightenment and so on that are given to us in the Upanishads. So Nyaya has very broad range. Everybody knows all the other schools, Buddhist, Vedantin, and other areas of literature, Alankara Shastra, the literary critics, the medical literature, the jurisprudence. They learn Nyaya. It's a core topic taught in the tolls, the schools of classical Indian civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with Shankar and Vedanta in the future. And again, I thank you for your time on the podcast. We'll have a link up to your book, and folks can take a look at it in their own time.